In thinking about this address this morning, it occurred to me that we should probably really begin with the moment of conception, talking about children's dreams. Those of you who are familiar with embryology will know that once the sperm and the egg unite, the egg starts to divide, and it divides in two, and then it divides in four, and then it divides in eight, and then it divides into 16, and there's this geometric proliferation of the cells until you have a little ball of cells, and then the ball dents. There's a dent, and the lower part of the dent turns into the brain, and the rest of the dent turns into the skin. The brain tissue is more related to skin tissue than any other tissue in the body. Interesting point. And then the human form begins to develop. And as soon as there is a collection of cells that is identifiable as an eye, that collection of cells begins to jiggle and exhibit rapid eye motion. And what we know is that in mammals, rapid eye motion in periods of quiescence is the primary physical correlative observable symptom of dreaming. Now, another point needs to be made here. We also know that we dream in other states in addition to rapid eye motion sleep, but we know virtually nothing about what those dreams are like because it's very difficult to get grant money to study it. The people who hand out grant money are not interested in handing out grant money for looking at people while they sleep and waking them up and maybe catching them while they're dreaming. They're much more interested in handing out grant money having to do with rapid eye motion sleep that we know is associated with dreaming. For me, the most interesting question all of that raises is, what are the fetuses dreaming about? What is the content, if one may use that term, of the dreams of a fetus that isn't even fully formed human being yet? It seems to me there are at least two levels of influence that we can speculate about. One is the interior life of the mother. My suspicion is that the placenta may protect the infant from various pathogens in the mother's body physically, and it may in fact have a similar function to perform psychologically and emotionally and spiritually, but I also find it impossible to imagine, and I take imagination very seriously, that the interior life of the mother and what the mother is dreaming is not also influencing this dreaming that the infant, the unborn infant, is going through. So there's this personal connection, I suspect. And then there is the source of life that has animated the fetus to begin with. In this crowd, the word would be God. I'm not real comfortable with that word, but sure. If you understand that I am using it as a placeholder, I think the Hindus are right. The Hindus say words have never soiled it. And I think that's true. So we're talking about something real, but we're talking about something that is always beyond our ability to make speech ripe. And so we're talking about that which cannot be spoken, not because it's some secret that an elite is trying to keep from other people, but because it is beyond words and images. And I suspect that that is as important or more important an influence on the dreams of children before they're born than whatever the mother is dreaming about. And that right at that early phase, you have a model of multiple influences twining together to create the experience of the dream. The immediate, physical, personal, this is what mom had to eat today. This is what she's upset about. This is what makes her happy. And this connection to the cosmos, this connection to the source of all. As the fetus develops, it spends 95 to 98% of its time in rapid eye motion. And once the child is born, that percentage goes down to somewhere between 75 and 85% of the time. So dreaming is the main occupation of newborn infants. Once children develop to the point where they can begin to share their dreams, they share dreams of astonishing archetypal resonance. It's one of the things that convinces me that Jung is right, is that little children, if you listen to their dreams, will tell you dreams that sound like the sacred narratives of the world, whether they have listened to people reading the Bible out loud or whatnot, or not. That this is a spontaneous phenomenon in the dreams of young children. And it's another one of the things that convinces me that Jung is right, that we are inherently predisposed to generate out of our own beings these transpersonal, transcultural, translinguistic, transgendered symbol dramas, archetypal dramas. I was a Head Start director in Marin County for 5 years, and it was one of my goals to persuade my staff and my parent policy councils to pay regular attention to the kids' dreams. And it was an uphill battle. They all thought this was some weird academic Euro-American trip that had nothing to do with them. And I don't know how many of you are familiar with Head Start. It's a great program. It is in deep jeopardy. This plan to shift Head Start funding from the federal government to the states is bogus. And people should write to their congresspeople and tell them not to do it. It is an evil plan. Enough of that footnote. I had staff meetings at the end of the week, every week on Fridays. Kids would get on the bus and go home, and the staffs from all the different programs would converge, and we would report on the week's activities and talk about the weekend and talk about the next week. And one of my programs, if you're all familiar with Marin County, there's a town way up at the northern border of Marin County called Novato. And culturally, it doesn't even belong to Marin. It belongs to Sonoma. But it's on the Marin side of the San Antonio Creek, so it's in Marin. And the Novato program was run by these charming hippies who were frozen in the amber of the 60s. They actually drove around in a VW bus with flowers painted on it. And they were always late. The staff meeting would begin, and we would not wait for the folks from Novato because they would always be half to three quarters of an hour late. So the meeting would be rolling, and the Novato folks would come in, and this time, same thing happened. We were fully into the meeting, and then the Novato folks rolled in, and we asked for a report from them about it, and they said, well, you know, we've been trying this Ask the Kid About Their Dreams thing that Jeremy's been talking about, and it's been working out for us pretty well. You guys all know how it is. You get there in the morning, and you straighten up the classroom, you make sure everything's ready, and you make your coffee, and the bus comes and the doors open and the kids come off the bus and the little boys are fighting with each other and they come into the class, trash the classroom, and you're behind the eight ball for the rest of the day. You all know about that. Well, since we've been doing this dream stuff, we get there early, we make sure the classroom is in good shape, we make the coffee, the bus arrives, the doors open, the little boys boil off the bus fighting with each other, and they all rush into the art corner to draw pictures of their dreams. And the day begins with the kids demanding a group process. We don't have to chase them around the room to get them into a group. They're already in a group demanding that we come and do it for them. You could hear a pin drop. And all the other staff people are going, really? And you get to finish your coffee? And they went, yeah, it's really been pretty good. So on the basis of that, all the other centers began to experiment with this listening to the kids' dream business, and it changed the culture of the program. It transformed it literally overnight. Any of you who are familiar with Head Start will probably be familiar with the internal class struggles that happen. There are the people who are in the classroom, and then there are the home visitors. And the home visitors believe that they are a superior kind of human being because they don't have to punch a time clock and they get to drive around and turn in vouchers for their gasoline and their lunches. And they're afraid of the classroom. It's like the classroom is a disease, and if they go into the classroom, they might catch it. So you really have to chase them around to get them into the classroom. Once we instituted the dream sharing, the home visitors were smart enough to get it right away that there was more reliable and valuable information about the home situation coming from the kids' dreams than any of the files and reports that they were reading. So the home visitors started buying gourmet coffee and coming in with cardboard trays of gourmet coffee and handing them out to the teachers and the volunteers so they could be there when the kids arrived and shared their dreams. And suddenly there was this cooperation between the home visitors and the teachers and the volunteers and the parents that we had been trying to cultivate for years with, you know, vacation workshops and trips to Santa Cruz, and none of it had worked, but this worked. Suddenly, there was a great deal more cooperation amongst the adults. And the Head Start staff themselves figured out, without my having to tell them, this archetypal association between dreaming about death and major transformation and growth in the dreamer's life, because it is as true for little children as it is for adults. Head Start kids dream about death, and my staff was paying attention, and they realized that they could correlate the dreams of death that the kids reported with the achievement of developmental milestones, which was part of their job, was to keep track of when it happened and what kids were delayed and what kids were precocious. And they noticed that these dreams about dying constellated up around the achievement of the developmental milestones. And they also noticed that if the kids dreamed about the parents being threatened with death and not dying, in the kids' dreams, the parents are threatened with death and they escape somehow, that it was a very reliable indicator that the kids themselves would probably engage in age-inappropriate regressive activity very quickly. And they even figured out a theoretical model for it, which I think is correct, that the little girl who didn't know how to tie her shoes felt loved by her parents best in all the world. And then she figures out how to tie her shoes, and she doesn't have the sense that the little girl who knows how to tie her shoes is loved best in all the world the way the little girl who didn't know how. And so in an unconscious, desperate effort to reacquire the parents' unconditional regard, she begins to exhibit other age-inappropriate behavior, imitating who she used to be before she knew how to tie her shoes. And of course, it has a disastrously counterproductive result. The parents get angry, they get frustrated. The whole scene goes from bad to worse. And the home visitors figured this out so that whenever a dream like that was reported in the morning, they would shift their priorities and slide off to visit that parent, you know, and fall by the house around 11 o'clock and say, you know, it's time to take a break, let's have some coffee, and get into casual conversation about how do kids grow so fast and how it's really hard when they turn two and learn to say no, but you have to love them anyway even when you do that, don't you think? Yeah, well, that's right. And you got to embrace them as they undergo all these changes, well, sure, without ever having to bring up the dream issues at all. Just understanding that that conversation needed to happen, that the parents needed to be reminded, needed to be tweaked, that the kids were growing, and that the same kind of unconditional love that they gave last week to the little girl who didn't know how to tie her shoes was even more necessary now this week, now that she'd figured it out. And the incidence of parental disruption due to inability to accept the achievement of developmental milestones just withered away. This dream work, attention to the dreams of the children, became so much a part of the program that they were still doing it 10 years later after I left as director. And I understood from them that it was in the face of severe pressure from the feds to cut it out, because the federal investigators would come in and look at the program and go, where did this come from? This isn't in the regs anywhere. What are you doing? And they were very sophisticated. My folks, they'd say, oh, it has to do with local culture. See, here's subsection 5, paragraph B, respect for local culture. Well, this is local culture. So leave it alone. And they pulled it off. They managed to make it work. The very fact that children are spontaneously inclined to dream about death, not in a symbolic form, but as death, in association with the achievement of developmental milestones, is, from my point of view, yet another piece of compelling evidence that this is an archetypal form. It is what is true for the children is true for us adults too. When death appears in the manifest content of the dream, nameable as death, it is practically 100% sure that some important level of that dream is celebrating, no matter how distressing it may be, it's actually a celebration of being in the midst of a process of growth and change and evolution and development that is so profound that only the death of who I used to be, or the death of some aspect of who I used to think I was, is an adequate symbol for the profundity of the process that folks are engaged in. One of the things I want to do today is to talk about dealing with the distressing emotional residues that often are left by these essentially positive nightmares when they are understood at depth. Oftentimes, kids would come into the program in the morning with very distressing dreams, and the standard policy was that we would begin the day with a group where the kids shared their dreams with one another, and the strategy to get them to share their dreams was to begin in the art corner and have them draw pictures of their dreams to begin with, and then to use the pictures as the discussion prompters for the sharing of the dream. I think this is an excellent way to promote dream sharing. I think it's an excellent way to promote dream sharing amongst adults. The problem is that most adults have to undergo a conversion experience before they'll dare do art. And if you can manage to inveigle them into making art and making drawings of their dreams, I think it's a wonderful way to work with adults as well. But it's clearly the best way to work with children. The younger the children are, the better the way it is. The younger the children are, the less point there is in verbal, if this were my dream, sort of chat. It's the experience that needs to be addressed directly. And one of the important things about making a drawing, whether it's articulated verbally or not, is that it changes the dreamer's relationship to the experience of the dream, particularly if it's a nightmare. If a kid comes in all distressed by the memory of a nightmare, the act of rendering that experience onto the page, even if it looks like a set of random black crayon scratch marks, alters the kid's relation to the feeling. The kid is now giving expression to the feeling. Instead of being at the mercy of the feeling is now being expressed, and the relationship is one of creative relationship rather than oppression. So often simply making random scratches on a page will transform the kid's relationship to the memory of the dream. Takes reacquire a sense of autonomy and influence over the dream rather than feeling at the mercy of the dream. It's true of working with all dreams. It's particularly true of working with nightmares. Most of the time, simply having the kid draw a picture of the nightmare before it's shared will dispel much of the distressing emotional residue of the dream. Many times that will not be enough. When it's not enough, when the kid is still roiled up and filled with distress, a second step is to encourage the kid to make a mask of the most distressing element in the dream. Now, in Head Start, we made it policy that the masks would be made from paper plates in order to minimize arguments about who has access to better materials than who else. So we standardized, we industrialized the mask-making process, and it skewed the process to some extent because all the masks ended up being round. Now, I think there was some theoretical benefit to that, since the circle is an image of integration itself. The circle is an image of integration, and it implies a center, and it implies harmony with the feminine. There are all sorts of archetypal energies that come unconsciously with using a pre-cut circle, but it also tends to militate against the non-circular, jagged images that often come up in dreams. And occasionally, the budding artist would insist on cutting the paper plate so that the jaggedness would show. Very interesting when a kid insists on doing that. Anyway, the best practice, if making a drawing and sharing the dream is not enough to dispel the residue of distress, having the kid make a mask of the most distressing element in the dream, which of necessity is going to be a shadow element, and then encouraging the kid to hold the mask up in front of his or her face and playfully act that character out, 99 times out of 100, that will then dispel the residue of distress. It also, at least in Head Start, had the effect of energizing all the other kids who got tremendously excited about the acting out of the monster. And then they started making up monster dreams so that they could make monster masks and act them out, which in itself, I think, is a very healthy activity. Once again, the issue came up at the staff meeting the first time this happened, and there was a big discussion about whether kids making up nightmares because it was so much fun to act them out was a bad idea or not. And my staff came to consensus very quickly that far from being a bad idea, it was a really good idea, and that you shouldn't go, "You're just making this up." You should go, "Oh, okay, here's a paper plate for you." Making the mask and acting it out is an amped up version of making the drawing, because the sense of being menaced and at risk from the memory of the monster figure in the dream, the shadow figure in the dream, is transformed by taking control of how this figure is presented in the world, and is transformed by the contact with playful creative energy, which in my experience is the most healing energy we have at our disposal. So that playfully acting out the monster alters the relationship to the source of the monster image in the dream. It becomes integrated, it becomes accepted through the play. So there is an integration. It's the beginning of the individuation process in very young children. It's an immensely valuable experience for them to have, and it works. Now, occasionally, in very distressing situations, even making the mask and acting out the distressing figure in the dream will not work. The kid will continue to be upset. There is a third step that you can take, and I am in an odd position in relation to this because I've never seen it fail. Now, that doesn't mean it can't fail. It just means I've never seen it fail. And I've never seen it fail even with adequately diagnosed, profoundly disturbed schizophrenic and autistic kids. This works across the board. If the initial mask making and mask play does not alter the sense of being oppressed and at risk and menaced by the figure in the dream, you can help the kid burn the mask. Now, it is important. I have seen it falter when it was done for the kid. The important thing is that the kid has to hold the mask and has to hold the fire and has to bring them together. Now, it can all be done with a guiding adult hand. In fact, the adult hands can be the ones that are actually doing the work, but the kid has to have the sense of doing it him or herself. If the kid is encouraged and helped to burn the mask, even the most distressing dream will ebb away into some kind of normalcy, even in schizophrenic and autistic kids, even in kids that are chemically predisposed to be roiled up and distressed all the time. Again, I think there are some implications here about the world of the archetypes, because fire itself is an archetypal image. It is the archetypal patron of change. using the four basic elements of the Western tradition, earth, air, fire, and water, everybody knows, it's a way to think about how archetypes work, everybody knows, regardless of language, regardless of age, regardless of gender, regardless of passionately held convictions, regardless even of our relative states of mental and emotional stability, we all know that things can be totally immersed in air and not be changed. That's the way we are all the time. We know that things can be sunk in the water and brought up again and not be fundamentally changed. We know things can be buried in the ground and dug up again and not be fundamentally changed. And we know nothing can be totally immersed in fire and not be changed. So I think it is the use of fire in this ceremonial ritual context that is the primary archetypal symbolic source of the healing. The kid is bringing the primal source of transformation, the primal symbol of irrevocable change, to the mask which he or she has already made and acted out of this broken off part of the psyche that is so threatening to the fragile ego that the ego hangs on to the fear and the terror even after successive efforts to integrate it and come together. It is important to burn the whole mask. If you leave little unburned chunks around, the effect will not be nearly as positive. You need to make sure that the whole thing is rendered into ashes. And as I say, I spent 12 years at a residential treatment program for schizophrenic and autistic children and adolescents and young adults, and I had on many occasions to go all the way through the process to burning the mask. And I never got to the end of the mask-burning ritual and did not see, the kids relax. The kids let go of their terror, become more tractable. It was what Martha Stewart would call a good thing. One of the things that's true about children is that they grow and change at what, from an adult perspective, is a dizzying pace, particularly in adolescence. I should probably say something about St. George. St. George Holmes was based on the clinical insights of Carl Jung, and the primary organizing principle of St. George was that as kids approached puberty, there were tremendous energies released from the psyche associated with that natural change into fully sexual beings. And that at that pubescent moment, those energies were there, and if you could channel them also in the direction of healing psychosis, you had a much better chance of kids entering adulthood as mere neurotics. And we were successful over and over and over again. And I have a selfish reason for telling this part of the story. I'm hoping you will understand where some of my sort of bad boy cynicism comes from. The founder of the program, a genius woman named Dorothea Romanescu, insisted that us senior staff people write up our successes for the journals. I mean, you've all heard the phrase publish or perish. Well, it in the university is mild compared to the way Dorothea used to be. We had to crank these articles out, and we would crank them out and send them off, and they would disappear into the void for 6 months, 8 months, a year and a half, 2 years. And then they would come back, and there would be all these coffee ring stains on them and endless notations in the margins in different color ink and different handwriting, and a cover letter which said, this was a very interesting article. We all read it multiple times, and we passed it out to adjudicators outside the journal. And if what you say happened, and we have no reason to believe that what you say didn't happen, then the kid couldn't have been schizophrenic to begin with. It must be a case of misdiagnosis, and we are not interested in publishing stories about misdiagnosis. And this happened over and over and over again. experiences of that kind make me cynical about conventional wisdom in the academic world and the political world and the economic world. We live in a world of bogus assumptions. And every time my experience has led me to the edge of something new, this kind of catch-22 comes up. So I tend to be rude about that stuff. It's not because I'm trying to insult people. It's because it's my experience. And that may help you to be less annoyed by my rudeness. When in adolescence, these volcanic changes, partially fueled by biology, majorly fueled by social experience, begin to kick in, one of the collective manifestations is this holocaust of adolescent suicide that we are living through. Now, I want to approach this with some delicacy because in a group this size, the sociological statistics alone say that there must be 5 to 10 people in this room who've been directly affected by this. And I do not wish to distress any of you with what I have to say about this phenomenon. And I want to apologize to begin with for even bringing it up. I know it's a very delicate question, but it's a crucially important one. And I think the importance of talking about it overrides the potential danger of bringing up deep sorrow in individuals. So please forgive me, those of you for whom this discussion becomes difficult. My experience, which is way more extensive than I wish it was, is that suicidal behavior, particularly in adolescence, is a species of dreaming awake. And that this fundamental archetypal metaphor associating death with profound transformation and change is at the root of the experience of going through the waking world, using all my willpower to focus my attention on the issues at hand, because the moment I relax, this spontaneous idea that I should kill myself pops into my head. Now, I have on at least two occasions been in this very room sharing the platform with Robert Johnson and watched Robert do his magical introduction to the unconscious in general and dreams in particular. And he tends to emphasize dreams and fantasies as a reliable source for discernment, that you should do what your dreams and your spontaneous fantasies tell you to do. And he has a rap that takes about an hour, and he runs it out, and I have seen on two occasions in this very room when he ends and says, you know, are there any questions or comments, some distressed, tentative hand will rise, usually from the back, and some distressed person will say, well, Dr. Johnson, I've been listening to you, and you seem to be saying that I should do what my dreams and fantasies are telling me to do, and my dreams and fantasies are telling me to kill myself. Surely you are not saying I should kill myself. And Robert, profound archetypal trickster that he is, listens carefully and nods his head and says, yes, indeed, you have been paying attention. That is indeed what I've been saying. If your dreams and fantasies are telling you to kill yourself, by all means, kill yourself. And then there's this shockwave that goes through the audience. Everybody goes, oh my God, I thought he was a nice person. I'm going to have to reevaluate everything. And while everyone's going, rah, 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 he adds, but do not harm your body. By all means, kill yourself, but do not harm your body. I think it is the best advice that can be given to suicidal folk. Because in essence, death in the dream world is this archetypal metaphor of profound growth and change. And there are essentially two varieties of profound growth and change that we human beings are heir to. There is the growth and change that will happen because time goes by. And we can dig in our heels and we can resist and we can postpone it, but ultimately it will happen because time makes it happen. Then there are those changes that will only take place if the ego and the will and the discernment process cooperates and facilitates it. Those kinds of changes, which I tend to think of as a higher order of change, tend to be symbolized in the dream world by murder and suicide. So that suicide in the dream world is a profoundly positive metaphor, no matter how distressing the immediate experience of the dream may be. It is, for example, one of the most positive prognostic dreams that someone in recovery from addiction can have. Because if the recovering addict dreams about suicide, what it tends to mean is this time it will work. This time the energies of the self are being mobilized to the point where the addict is going to die, and the only one who can cause the addict to die is the addict, him or herself. So the metaphor, the natural metaphor, is suicide. And I believe that this is true across the board, and that what is happening with these folks who are assailed by obsessive thoughts of self-destruction is that they are dreaming awake, and that the urgent message is you, dreamer, must change your life so radically that the person you are now is gone. And you can do it. I think the same thing applies to the spontaneous fantasies as applies to the dreams remembered from sleep. If these fantasies assail me on a regular basis, it means I am capable of carrying out the symbolic transformation which they are urging. And it is the most poignant example I know of the dangers of mistaken literalism. This is not about killing the body. This is about releasing the soul and the psyche from prematurely closed personae and social prisons and things which are death to the authentic self. The statistics are very clear. One of the primary factors associated with adolescent suicide is gender orientation. And kids who believe that they may be gay or lesbian or bi, who are growing up in societies in which that is absolutely taboo, feel pressed up against a wall where the only possibility that seems viable for them is killing themselves. At a symbolic level, it's true. The problem is mistaken literalism. And may you never be in a position to be having to counsel people in this position. But if you are, I would admonish you to try Robert's suggestion. By all means, kill yourself, but do not harm your body. That this is a spontaneous announcement from the depths of the psyche that that order of transformation, of total transformation, is possible. It's not going to be easy. In the short run, it's not going to be pleasant. But it is possible. If it were not possible, the obsessive thoughts would not even press against my awareness to begin with. Everything I know says that that is true. And in terms of projective dream work, one of the ways that I know it's true is that having been in a position to make this suggestion to suicidal folk for decades, it has been greeted by the aha of recognition every time. Now, once again, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's always true, but it has been greeted by the aha of recognition every time. And it's magical. The recognition comes and the entire emotional set shifts. Suddenly, the whole problem is seen in a different light. Now, the person may not necessarily cheer up, but at least the discussion is shifted from killing themselves into how can I possibly be who I am in a world that I believe rejects my authentic being entirely. And that's a very depressing discussion to have, but it's way better than killing yourself. Way better. And as I say, may you never be in the position to experiment with this piece of information. But if you are in a position, I would urge you to give it a try. You have nothing to lose, it seems to me, and potentially everything to gain. Now, this is, as I say, particularly poignant and apt in adolescence, but my experience is that it is as true of adult suicidal folks as it is of adolescent and child suicidal folks.
So we heard about people being ready for this kind of dream.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was wondering what you said about the ego will and discernment. then is a next step to try to support those three things for that to grow? Or does it mean this has already happened when they're dreaming it? Or does it mean they're on the cusp?
There must be a box in there labeled all of the above. See, it comes back to this overwhelming experience that the dream models waking life. And it models waking life symbolically. And if there's one thing about this experience that's most important, it is the awareness that there are multiple levels of meaning simultaneously all the time, awake and asleep. So that in doing waking life counseling with a suicidal person, all of the things that you describe are true simultaneously, depending on the level of psyche that's being addressed. And that the strategies of talking to such a person, in my experience, are often best focused by attempting to bring consciousness to the deeper levels of psyche, where it's true that it's already happened. Where the obsessive voices saying, kill yourself, kill yourself, kill yourself, originate from, because that's the place where it's already happened, where the psyche knows this can be done. In some sense, the change has already happened. It's the waking life that hasn't been able to keep up with it. But if you are addressing the surface of psyche in distressed, intermittent conscious awareness, obviously the feeling is going to be that that's not so. That I'm not ready and I can't do it. And at that point, all I can say to clients, I tend to think of them as clients who are in that position, is everything I know says, you're the only one who can say, really, but everything I know says you wouldn't even be having these obsessive voices if you couldn't do what they're asking for. Now, you can avoid it theoretically by killing yourself, but my experience, I don't say this often, but for particular personalities, it's a useful thing to say, is you think this problem will be solved by killing yourself? You're just going to have this same problem in the afterworld, and you aren't even going to have the same kind of tools for dealing with it. So why not do it here where it's easier? See, I happen to think, and again, I wouldn't recommend this line of counseling for people who don't actually believe it, but at this point, I am inclined to believe that the Tibetans are right, that the Tibetan Buddhists say that what we experience as the dream when we are alive and incarnated, it's worth remembering that the karn in incarnation is the same karn as in chili con carne. It means being made out of meat. As long as we're made out of meat, what we experience as the dream and remember as the dream is exactly what the discarnate soul experiences after death. That to die is to go into the land of the dream and not return. So if you're trying to get away from stuff and you think killing yourself is going to do it, you might want to reconsider. Hamlet is right. He says, why don't I raise arms against all these indignities? Except for what dreams may come. You know, I think Hamlet's right. And it is an archetypal notion. The Nupé people of sub-Saharan Africa, for instance, tell their dreams to each other on a regular basis because they take their dreams very seriously. And the language form they use is, rather than saying I was asleep and dreaming, they say I was half dead. So if you're sitting around, if you're in Nupé culture and you're sitting around telling your dreams, you'll say, well, I was half dead and blah, 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 blah. Halfway into that world, exactly. And any place where Shakespeare and sub-Saharan African folk and Tibetan Buddhists all say the same thing, I think we have to take it seriously. The least one can say about that is that we human beings are inherently predisposed to imagine that life after death is like a dream. That death is like sleep, and the experience of the soul after death is like dream. That is incontrovertible. Whether it's actually true or not is another question. I am personally inclined to think that it's true. But that's more by way of a faith statement. But because it's an archetypal notion, whether it's true or not, it can be very useful in a counseling situation like that. Because no matter what the conscious convictions are, raising the possibility that your experience after you kill yourself is going to be just as bad as it is beforehand is going to awaken some kind of aha of recognition and may in fact serve as a break on that desperate, unhappy behavior, which seems to me in those situations to be what we're looking for.
What scares me is that all of that stuff we haven't worked out is going with us.
Oh, yes. The testimony of the world's sacred narratives is that that's how it works. You know, there's that, the closest thing to fiction that Carl Jung ever wrote is the Seven Sermons for the Dead, Septuum Sermones ad Mortuos. And we here in America are in an advantageous position because Anna and Ilya Yaffe convinced Jung to publish the Seven Sermons as an appendix to the American version of the autobiography Memories, Dreams, Reflections. It isn't even in the British version. And apparently Jung thought, oh, that's America, that's the other side of the world, it doesn't matter. So we do have access to the Seven Sermons, and we have access to the experience that he had in the waking world that prompted it, a feeling that his house was suddenly invaded by ghosts. And as he reports it, the ghosts were really unhappy. And they say, we thought when we died we would at least get the basic answer, is there a God or isn't there? Only we've been dead for a long time and it's just as ambiguous to us now as it was before. And we're enraged. And so he takes on the voice of the Gnostic teacher Valentinius. He speaks as though he is Valentinius of Alexander. And he preaches seven sermons to the dead, which in fact repeat, like all good sermons, repeat the point that if you want to solve these problems after you're dead, the only really viable tactic available to you is to support your offspring while they are alive in their efforts to solve the problem.
What is worthy of self-sacrifice in that view?
That sounds like an immensely important question, and I'm not sure I understand it.
Well, just on one hand, keeping in mind, kind of take charge of your life and deal with it consciously, make choices for yourself.
The best that can be done.
Right.
Yeah.
Versus more like the way of the cross, where I'm sacrificing myself to something greater than myself. Not keeping in mind my idea of what is best in mind, because I might not even have the idea of what is best in mind.
Oh, bless your heart. That is an important question. Well, theater of anxiety. It's a tough message for this crowd, but since you've asked, let me say it. The archetype of willing sacrifice is, in my experience, the archetypal pattern of individuation across the board of psychospiritual growth and change. It is an immensely powerful archetype. And just because it's an immensely powerful archetype does not mean that it is not vulnerable to distortion and exploitation. And I believe that one of the reasons that patriarchal sexism has had a several thousand year run, despite its totally bogus assumptions, is that one of the things it's done is to offer to women an off-the-rack way of acting out the archetype of willing sacrifice. Honey, you can give yourself to me. You can make my life good. And you'll feel good in the process. And the irony is that at a deep spiritual level, there is truth to that. That giving up one's essential self with the thought that it is being done for love and some higher purpose is one of the most satisfying experiences that ego consciousness and the self can have. And talk about addiction, it is a venue for addiction. The feeling good about participating in the archetype of willing sacrifice and turning away from the actual consequences of it, the actual ultimate triviality of the things that I am being asked to give up my authentic being for. And like all addictive behaviors, perverting the archetype of willing sacrifice becomes an addiction because it serves as a mechanism for numbing me as the one who participates in it from the full impact of my experience. That's why I was saying last night when Susan was mentioning that addiction doesn't have to be connected to substances. That's a crucially important point. And she was saying, I've never met anybody addicted to prayer. Well, I have. Most of the serious addicts that I know are addicted to prayer and good works. Because when things come up out of their own interior depths that they don't want to look at and don't want to deal with, they look around for somebody to help because that's an interesting enough thing. It echoes with the archetype of willing sacrifice sufficiently for some of that archetypal juice to be felt, to be experienced. But it's felt and experienced unconsciously for the purpose of not feeling the unanswered question. And so it is by definition an addiction. And when these folks can't find other people to help, they pray. Pray. Because prayer is, it's not quite as good as helping other people, but it's good enough to numb my sense of what I really ought to be doing and to feel good about what I am doing. Now, that's a tough one for this crowd. But it's very easy to talk about other people's addictions. And it's an invitation to be addicted and not notice. And so it seems to me that the question having been asked, I am required to say what I've just said.
How does that person dream with a non-addictive willing sacrifice?
My experience is that the dream is much more likely to make the symbolic equivalent of snide remarks about things that I think are wonderful willing sacrifices, which are in fact evidences of addiction. Dreams of being at what look like very beautiful and satisfactory church services, only I look and realize that the whole thing is a flat canvas stage set. That kind of thing. I hear some ahas of recognition. In the audience.
So my discernment, this Episcopal Church is important.
It's important everywhere. It's absolutely crucial. And I think Robert's point about how the dreams and spontaneous fantasies are the most reliable source for adequate discernment is correct. The problem, which I don't think Robert gives sufficient attention to, is that we are all uniquely blind, uniquely and selectively blind to what the dreams and spontaneous fantasies are saying, and the invitation to mistaken literalism is overwhelming, which is another one of the reasons why I think it's so important for us to share this kind of stuff. The more important it is, the more numinous and glowing it is, the more important it is to share with trustworthy people and to stay open to their suggestions, remembering that I am the only one who can evaluate what they have to say. But with any luck at all, I am going to hear things from them that I would not think on my own. And it will be of incalculable worth. Well, thank you very much.